originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now, here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and extending a very special welcome to everyone joining us across HRN Nation, including all of you who are listening live throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM 201, and all of you tuned in to our free live streaming or archived podcast. If you're listening that way, of course, you're doing that through our website at horseracingradio.net. Excited to have you with me for the next hour, and I am excited for the next hour because we're going to have the chance to visit with a young trainer in our sport who is really making a mark, and he's been doing things the right way for several years now, but things really starting to go to a new level. He is the 37-year-old native of Oxford, England, who began his career with just three horses in 2011 and is now preparing to saddle his very first Breeders' Cup starter on Friday when Hit the Road will go postward in the $1 million Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. He is, of course, trainer Dan Blacker, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited for you. I know this is an exciting time for you, getting closer to those Breeders' Cup World Championships. And look, you're based in Southern California. This is your home track. Has to be exciting for you, too.
Yeah, there's always a real buzz when the Breeders' Cup comes to any place. But I always feel like Santa Anita, there's something special about this place when the Breeders' Cup come here. With the maybe it's the natural amphitheater with the mountains surrounding the track and the light and the warm weather, but there's a real buzz, and it's really exciting to have a horse that's in contention this year.
Is there a better setting in all of horse racing, at least here in the United States, to go out and watch morning workouts than what we see at Clocker's Corner looking at those majestic San Gabriels?
I don't think, you know what, I'm very fortunate that I get to call this like my office. You know, I come out every morning here, and we're very lucky in Southern California to have such good weather most of the time. And, you know, to come out and see those mountains every day with the sun coming up over the top, it never gets old. But then, you know, when Breeders' Cup rolls around, it does get a bit more of a buzz. It's pretty exciting. So,
yeah, Clocker's Corner is already filling up. It will be packed over the course of the couple of days leading up to Breeders' Cup as everybody comes out to see the horses train in the mornings. And as I say, one of the great settings that we have in the sport of thoroughbred racing. And if people haven't done it, they really need to make a trip to Santa Anita and check that out. Dan, do you even allow yourself to think ahead to Friday afternoon and what it might be like if Hit the Road crosses the finish line first?
I'd be lying if that, you know, that thought doesn't cross my mind. But I try to just not think about that as much as possible. I just try and think about the preparation for the horse and everything we can do leading up to the race, make sure all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, and, you know, everything. There's a lot to think about in terms of schooling and, you know, day-to-day preparation. Try and get everything run as smoothly as possible for the horse, and that's what I try and you know, and I have the rest of my horses in my stable to fill my time with as well. Everything, the day-to-day job requires a lot of thought, and I think about it a lot. So to answer your question, I try to, it is possible, it enters my head at some point, but I try and like push it back as much as I can.
Yeah, you know, he's a horse that has been so good to you. 2-for-3 lifetime. He lost his maiden start and then came back and broke his maiden in his second start and won the Zuma Beach at Santa Anita on October 6th. When did you first get the sense that Hit the Road could be a pretty special horse?
Well, Craig Rounsfell of Boomer Bloodstock is an Australian guy. We've been friends for a long time. We did the Dali Flying Start together, which is now the Godolphin Flying Start. We've been friends for a long time. He's a Bloodstock agent. We actually picked this horse out together at the yearling sale last year, keen in September. He was actually hip 16 out of 4,000 horses. So it was like he was really early in the sale. And Boomer especially picked him out and really loved him. We both were very fond of him, and we thought he was hip 16. We thought we got probably no chance of getting him because he has a super pedigree. You know, he's by Global Sire, More Than Ready, and out of a family which has a number of grade one milers in it. So, I mean, he was just one that we felt we weren't going to get, and we were just really lucky he slipped through the net and RNA'd, and we went back to the barn and bought him. But right from the beginning, we felt like he was precocious and felt like he was going to be a nice horse. Craig was really high on him right from the beginning, but at the same time, you keep your feet on the ground about these sort of things. Lots, you know, we bought horses before that we had, you know, every horse that we buy, we have a lot of excitement about. But then, you know, when he first came in, he didn't show as much speed as I expected him to. You know, he looked like a real fast, early type when we bought him. And then, you know, once we got him going, he didn't really show as much speed as I thought. And so I was kind of, you know, a little bit disappointed in that at that point. But I was still had a lot of optimism about him going two turns, you know. So, and that's how it ended up.
When you say that he looked like a fast early type when you bought him, that's a term that we hear quite often in the sport of thoroughbred racing. But I'm quite sure, Dan, there are people listening going, okay, well, what on earth does that look like? So when you look at a horse at a sale, what does a fast early type horse look like?
Well, you remember when you were at high school and you were maybe a freshman and there was that kid in the class that was like way bigger than everyone else. And he like just was like, and playing football or whatever, he just dominated because he was like way more way more advanced and developed than the other kids in that grade. Now, when the kids got to their final year of high school, like everyone else had kind of caught up and he wasn't quite so dominant. Well, that's what we talk about when we say fast, early types, precocious horses. These horses like hit the road. We expected him to be a good two-year-old, like as in he looked like an early developing sort, and we call them precocious, and that's ended up how he turned out. You know, he turned out very precocious and obviously broke his maiden in July of his two-year-old year, which is pretty early. And he's always been mentally and physically very developed very early in his life. You know, some horses don't even start until they're three or four, whereas he's already won in the middle of his two-year-old year and is obviously a very special horse that he can be a Breeders' Cup contender. So, like, when we say precocious, that's generally what we mean when they are tend to lean towards being competitive as a two-year-old, you know. And I'm hoping that he can, you know, however he runs next weekend, how he can go on and compete and be a good three- and four-year-old as well. But that's to be determined, you know. We'll see.
Yeah, so often when we talk about horses that look like they could be fast early types, they tend to, especially with those young two-year-olds, they tend to get out there, break from the gate, and just go and never look back. Hit the Road, when he won the Zuma Beach, he was dead last, and he made a move coming from the back and drew off and won like an old professional horse. Is that something that you worked with him on in the mornings, or did he just do it naturally?
No, I think it's probably a bit of both. I mean, as I said before, he looked pretty fast when we bought him, and that's why when I got him going in the beginning of the year, in the spring, I was kind of a little disappointed he wasn't showing more natural speed. You know, once I got that point, well, I was hoping that he would show ability going two turns, you know. And so once I'd seen he wasn't showing natural speed, we got him onto the grass, which is where he was bred to be. And, you know, I wasn't surprised that he dropped back in his maiden. And, you know, I didn't rush him. I didn't, you know, really in his works. I didn't push him to show speed, and naturally that's what he wasn't showing he wanted to do. So I didn't try and change that, you know, and we nurtured the fact that he wasn't naturally really fast and didn't want to show natural speed. So we nurtured that and let him relax. And that's why after his first start on the dirt sprinting, we had the little small blinkers on. And after that, once we ran him a route on the grass, I took the blinkers off because I just wanted him to settle and have a kick and a turn of foot at the end. So, and that's luckily that's what he did. So.
Well, I mentioned you grew up in Oxford, England, some 5,300, nearly 5,400 miles away from Santa Anita. How many family members will be in attendance at the Breeders' Cup come this weekend?
Actually, just one. I mean, obviously my close family, my wife and my kids will be here and my in-laws. But my mother is actually coming out. She was coming out. She organized the trip like 6 months ago. So it's just... She came out for the Breeders' Cup the last time Santa Anita was Breeders' Cup host, and she came out again mostly to see my kids and just hang out and have a nice trip away from gloomy England. But obviously it's great to have her here at the same time as having a Breeders' Cup runner as well.
You know, you mentioned your wife, and that is Christina Blacker, who is a popular personality on TVG. She's actually done some work with us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network in the past. I'm a huge, huge fan of your wife, and don't take that the wrong way.
Me too.
Yeah, a big fan of hers. You have the three beautiful little girls, right? You have Margot, Violet, and Eliza. So things have worked out pretty good for Dan Blacker since coming to the United States.
Yes, I've been very lucky in my family life in that respect, yes.
How'd you meet Christina?
We met at Santa Anita on the backside. I was working for Richard Mandela at the time, and she came to interview him about something, and we met at the barn, and always just got on really well. So we met while I was working as an assistant trainer.
You know, it's funny, Dan. I always ask trainers, you know, what makes other trainers so good? So I'll ask you about Richard Mandela here in a minute since you spent time working with him. But Christina, when you see her on television and the way she does her job is so consistent and so good. So you know her better than anybody. What makes Christina Blacker so good at her job?
Her work ethic. Like she, for one, she is how you see her on TV and how you see her on a professional basis is very much how she is in real life, like back at home. She's a really honest person. That's what really shines through when you see her on TV. And what she's exactly the same as she is on TV as she is in real life. She's a very sincere, honest person. And I think that's why she's so good at what she does on air. But, I mean, the main reason why she is so good is her work ethic. I mean, she works insane hours. And, like, people think that she just gets up on TV, reads an auto cue or whatever, and then once the cameras go off, she goes home and that's it. My alarm went off this morning at 4:30. Her alarm went off at the same time. She's up, not doing stuff with the kids, but got open the computer, looking at PPs, getting ready for the day, like, and then she's out here interviewing people. She just studies and works so hard and to improve her knowledge of every single part of every single race she's covering. Looking at PPs, she's a really good handicapper, and so she's so prepared. She's over prepared for everything she does, and that's why she's so good at it. And she's just very talented, and on top of that, works super hard. So, and I'm saying that is the honest truth.
Yeah, and you know, of course, your job training racehorses. By the way, visiting with Dan Blacker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Your job is 365 days a year. You're up early. You're at the barns. You know, horses, they eat on Christmas. They eat on Thanksgiving. Somebody has to be there. Quite often we race on those days here in this sport. So how do you and Christina, you mentioned how hard she works, how do you balance all of that and raise your three little girls?
Yeah, it's really hard. I won't lie. It's really hard. Both of us have full-time jobs, but Christina is like a super mom. I mean, I got so lucky because when you, you know, when I married her, you don't really know what sort of person she's going to be as a mom, as a wife, but like she is just like a super mom with the children. I mean, obviously we have help, like Christina's cousin works for us, and then we have a couple other nannies that kind of come on rotation, help us out. But I mean, it's just Christina. She's just like a super mom. I mean, she does her TVG work. She works for Keeneland. She does the I Am Horse Racing thing. And then on top of all that, she also is like a mom for the children. And, you know, she's reading to them every day. She's like coaching them at certain stuff. I mean, it's like she has, I just feel tired just looking at her sometimes. it's a bit of a cliche, but she is my rock and she's everyone's rock. My kids' rocks. I mean, she's like the central part of our family and holds everything together. She's a machine.
All right, so we started talking about two-year-old Hit the Road going in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. So let me ask you this question with the three little girls. Are there some similarities between raising a young horse like Hit the Road and raising three little girls? Are there any comparisons to be made there?
Yeah, it's funny. I often, when you're just around horses the whole time, you often do things. I find myself thinking, having a little chuckle to myself about similarities like that, the way that children act, or, you know, like my daughter, she hurt her foot the other day, my youngest daughter, and I see her walking or running, and I just saw her running away from me. I see her a little off. I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's a little off on the left front. And I'm like, wait, she's only got two legs. There's no... But that's the way a trainer's mind thinks. And then, like, also, like, they are very, at a certain point of those children's lives, the humans, they are very similar mentally to horses. You know, they're very like horses are very simple. Like they like routine, and a lot of the times they're just thinking about like where their next meal is coming from, what they're going to do right now. And so there's a certain point of a human being's life where they're very similar to a horse, but it's only for a very short period of time. So there are some similarities. Yes, it's quite funny.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. What do you think? Are they going to be horse trainers? Are they going to be TV personalities, media folks? What do you think the girls are going to want to do?
Man, the three of them are so different. And luckily, they're all three are really smart, like my wife. So I'm hoping they don't, you know, go down the horse trainer trainer route. But, you know, whatever they want to do, I'll support them. But I'm not pushing them into the horse business in any speak. I mean, hopefully they just stay in school and do what they want to do, you know. But whatever path they follow, I'll support them.
Where did this journey begin for you, Dan? How did you get introduced to horses and horse racing?
My father, like my dad was a steeplechase jockey in England, but he retired the year I was born, and so I never knew him as a jockey. But he's an artist, an equine sculptor by profession, and he's one of the foremost equine sculptors in the world. You know, he's done a lot of life-size statues of very famous racehorses. He in North America, his most famous one here is Northern Dancer at Woodbine. There's a life-size statue of Northern Dancer at Woodbine. He did that. And then many more in Europe and Australia and Malaysia, and Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, he's one of the top guys in the world. And so I got immersed into racing through him and became interested in it. And then I grew up in the country in England on a farm. And so I rode horses from a really early age and started riding around the farm, just ponies and things like that. So I knew how to riding horses and being around horses was second nature to me. And so I always had an interest in that. And while I was growing up, I just started working for trainers to earn a bit of money on the side, and slowly but surely just got more and more into it. And that's how I followed that path.
You know, your dad is, you know, we talked about, was a accomplished steeplechase jockey too, and then decided to, you know, after that get into the sculpting thing. Was he was he still a sculptor even when he was riding races, or did that come afterwards?
Yeah, when he was riding, he started doing some sculpting just as his hobby. He met this incredible lady named Margot Dent, who was a sculptor, and who my oldest daughter is named after. And they met by chance, and they ended up being great friends, and she was his mentor for sculpture. And so he worked under her, and then when he retired from race riding, you know, steeplechase jockeys in England retire young because it's so tough on their bodies. They don't go riding till they're in their 50s or 60s, like here, the flat jockeys here. He retired about, you know, when he was in his early 30s. So he had a whole life ahead of him, and he decided that he wanted to get into sculpture and try and do it professionally. And that's, you know, he was one of those irritating people that was very good at two completely different things in life. So, you know, he was a great jockey, and then he went on and is an even better sculptor. And he was lucky he got the chance to do a life-size statue of Red Rum at Aintree, who won the Grand National. He's also won the Grand National 3 years, three times. And Dad did the life-size statue of him as the first one he ever did, and that was at Aintree. And so that really just got the ball rolling, and he took off from there as a professional sculptor.
Did he want you to be involved in horse racing?
No. He knew how tough it is. He never encouraged it with me at all. It was almost the opposite. He didn't really want me to get involved. And I was lucky that he supported me, and I had an idyllic childhood growing up in the country and in England, and my parents did everything they could to give me a good education. I went to high school and I went to college, studied environmental geoscience at Edinburgh University, you know, completely nothing to do with horse racing. But at the same time, I was always working for trainers in my school holidays. In college, like, I would go and work for a trainer called Peter Monteith before classes, and just to kind of keep going. And I just was always passionate about working with horses. And then when I finished university, I decided that I didn't want to pursue a career in environmental geoscience, and I was very fortunate that I applied and got onto the Darley Flying Start program, and that's where everything really took off from there.
You know, people are going to listen to this, Dan, and they're going to say, wait a minute, he has a degree in the geoscience side of things and decided I'd rather get up every morning at 4 a.m. and work 365 days a year and break my back around horses then take advantage of that wonderful education that I got. What makes a person want to do that?
You just got to be passionate about it. And it's funny, I talk to my friends that aren't in horse racing now, and I explain to them, I get up at 4:30 every single day, 7 days a week, and it's like they just can't fathom what that life must be like. And I was the same when I was in college. I couldn't understand how that would work. But then once you get into it and you get into the routine, man, I couldn't even think about going back to a normal, so to speak, life now. You know, I mean, it's just part of the routine, you know, part of the deal of training horses. And, you know, like, I was just passionate about horses. I love being around horses. And the older I got, the more I missed spending time around horses. And once I finished school, I just decided that's really what I'd wanted to do. And then I did the Darley program and got more and more involved in the business. And then really the thing that really sealed it for me is coming to America. Like, and California especially, I really felt like this was my home. I loved the American industry, and I love the racetrack life here. And really, when I came here, everything fell into place, and I knew this is where I wanted to be.
What was the conversation like with your parents after you graduated and decided that you were going to pursue a career in horse racing? What was that like?
It was fine. Like, they were both horse people, and
yeah,
they weren't. You know, they were really pleased that I was accepted onto the Flying Start program, and they were excited for that. They just my parents were just very supportive in wherever I wanted to go, you know. So it could have been anything. If whatever I had said I wanted to do, they would have been supportive.
Talking with Dan Blacker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, just days away from saddling his first Breeders' Cup starter. As you heard at the top of the show, began his training career in 2011, and now it could go to a new level if he could pull off that win in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. Dan, you mentioned Flying Start, and that's a program that Sheikh Mohammed created through his Darley, and that is one of the great programs that we have in thoroughbred racing today. Talk to people about that program and why it's so good.
You know what? It really changed my life. I was so fortunate to be accepted on the program. And it's a brainchild of Sheikh Mohammed. The ruler of Dubai, there was no real program like it. There were other little programs like the Irish National Stud Course and things like that, but this was really revolutionary, and he wanted to do something that could to really give back to the industry in terms of, and the young people, give them more of something to work towards. And then so they created this program. What it is, it's a two-year internship. Mostly for graduates and people that want to go into the management level positions in the thoroughbred business. So they take 12 mostly graduates from around the world every 2 years, and they bring them all together, and you travel around the world to Sheikh Mohammed's breeding on racing operations over a two-year period, travel around all together, learning about racing and breeding, and at the same time doing internships, externships with different trainers and organizations, depending on where you want to go at the end of the course. And it's all expenses paid. They give you an allowance so you can live. And it was an incredible thing to be part of. I was very fortunate to be accepted on the program. It changed my life. I spent time in England, Ireland, France, Dubai, Australia, America, California, and at the end of it, I was fortunate enough to get offered a job with Richard Mandela, and I would never have been here if it wasn't for that program. So I owe everything up to that.
Yeah, it's a great program, and I want to continue to talk about it with you here on the second side of the program here when we come back from this commercial break. I want to ask you about some of your favorite stops along that tour when you were going through the Darley Flying Start, some of the people you met, maybe some of the things that you learned that you're still implying with your operation today. So we'll do that when we come back, visiting with trainer Dan Blacker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
One book, one session, one spectacular evening. On November 5th, the stars will align at Fasig Tipton, featuring a catalog of top race fillies, world-class broodmares, and selected weanlings. A night of stars with over 60 graded stakes winners or producers and no less than 24 grade one winners, champions, or producers. No Sale offers a higher concentration of quality anywhere in the world. The world's premier breeding stock event, the November Sale, November 5th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Denali Stud has made their mark selling Saturday afternoon horses. This year, Denali was the leading consigner by average at the prestigious Saratoga Sale, with yearlings averaging $728,000, including $2 million horses and the co-sale topper. At Keeneland September, Denali sold 20 of 21 yearlings offered in Book 1 and was the fourth leading consigner overall. With 800 acres and a management team led by two Kentucky Farm Managers of the Year, it's easy to see why Denali Stud is selling Saturday afternoon horses.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
In the recent Blood Horse Market Watch study of leading consigners with more than 100 yearlings offered from 2014 to 2016, Millridge Sales ranked highest among percentage of stakes horses and winners of $100,000 or more. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 34 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners. Their consignment at this year's Keeneland September sale includes yearlings from deep families by leading stallions such as Candy Ride, Curlin, Empire Maker, Ghost Zapper, More Than Ready, Quality Road, and Uncle Mo. Millridge, raising and selling racehorses. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, exactly how do the Flair strips work?
Mike, remember that a horse only breathes through its nose when it's running. About 50% of the resistance to getting the oxygen through the nose and into the lungs is at the nasal passages. They're the narrowest part of the upper airway, and that's where Flair strips work. The strips are proven to help prevent the nasal passages from collapsing, so horses breathe easier and get the oxygen they need more efficiently.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And from the back of the field, hit the road, circling up into contention. They're at the top of the stretch. War Beast, the leader. Here comes Encoder now, coming with a ferocious rally, and so is Hit the Road. And Hit the Road has gone right by Encoder. Suddenly, Billy Bats gets some room late, but it is Hit the Road. Look at him stride out comfortably, and Hit the Road will jog in the Zuma Beach. War Beast holds second. Billy Bats, Encoder flattened out late and has to settle for fourth.
Hit the Road, Jack. Yeah, Hit the Road. Big win in the Zuma Beach Stakes. That was Frank Miramati with the call. That was at Santa Anita back earlier this month. And Hit the Road, going to be heading to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf for 37-year-old trainer Dan Blacker. He is my special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. It will be his first Breeders' Cup starter coming up on Friday afternoon, and no doubt a special moment for him just to be there and saddle Hit the Road. But imagine if the horse would actually cross the finish line first. Well, we talked about that in the first half of the program. If you missed any portion of the show, just head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can download the show, click and listen at your leisure. The podcast available for you every single week, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And all of our guests who appear on the program going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll send those out to Dan and get those in his care, and look forward to seeing all of his horses in the winner's circle wearing those Flair strips coming up in future races. All right, Dan, part two of Trainer Talk here, at least second half of the program. We left off talking about Darley Flying Start and what it meant to you. And you said, I wouldn't be where I am today without that program. They take you all over the world. So what are some of the stops along the way that stood out to you that you say, man, I'm so glad I got a chance to do that?
I mean, all of it was very, each place was very unique, and I learned so much in each spot. But I mean, we started off in Ireland, based at Kildangan Stud, and generally the routine would be have like lectures and school in the mornings, and we'd have people come in and talk to us from the industry, and work towards our diploma. And then in the afternoons, in wherever, whatever location we were at, we'd go and do practical work. We'd spend time with the horses, and such like. So then after that, after we spent time at Kildangan Stud, which is the Darley Stud in Ireland, we went to Dalham Hall, which is the Darley farm in Newmarket, England. And then we started at Jonah Bell Farm, which is the Darley farm in Kentucky, where they, you know, a lot of change in that since then. But that's basically how it started. And then we were in Kentucky for about 8 months. Or in America for about 8 months. The last part of that, I was in California on a placement. That was my first externship. I did that placement with Richard Mandela in California. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Australia. We were in Australia for about four or five months. We worked on the farm in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, and did a little school work. And then I did my externship placement with David Hayes, who's a trainer in Australia. A lot of the other students, they would work in other, not just for trainers, but for whatever organization they were interested in focusing on. I always wanted to be a trainer, so that's where those are the people that I work for. So, And then, like, went back to England. And then we went to Dubai. I worked for Godolphin for some period of time there in Dubai. And then back to England, I worked for Jeremy Nasida. So, man, we just got to go all over and experience every facet of the thoroughbred industry. It's just so much of it was memorable. I can't really touch on one thing.
Those are some pretty big names that you threw out there, too. Nasida, Mandela, David Hayes. What did you take away from each of them? And I know you spent more time with Richard too, and we'll talk about that, but what did you take away from each of those trainers that's kind of helping you today as you structure your operation?
Yeah, I try and, you know, like looking back, it's something that you try and take as much as you can from each guy. And I'm sure there's a little piece of everything I do day to day that I learned from all of those guys. And the other guys that I haven't mentioned, I spent time with Jonathan Pease as well. He's a trainer in France prior to the Flying Start. But, I mean, you know, you take a little piece of everything, all the trainers you work for. I mean, Richard especially, because I train in California, what his methods and his horsemanship was especially particular, because that's, you know, I train in California and there are a lot of things you do here specifically for California, training horses in California, that you wouldn't do elsewhere. And so, like, Richard was a huge influence on my style and the way I try and do things around the barn, and especially in terms of horsemanship. He was a big influence on me, and you know, out of all the people I work for, I mean, he was probably the person that I look to, you know, in terms of horsemanship. And I still talk to him to this day. If I, you know, I ask him questions and things like that. So he was a big mentor in my life.
What's the greatest piece of advice that he's ever given to you?
there's probably not one greatest piece of advice. But, like, there's one thing he said to me that always randomly sticks in my mind. He said, start where you want to finish. And he meant as in, if you want to be at Santa Anita, and this is the way you start at Santa Anita and work your way up. You know what I mean? So as opposed to go to another track and think of a different track that you, as a starting point, with the goal of ending up at Santa Anita. He said to me, like, if you want to be at such and such a place, you start there and work your way up. So, I mean, that's not the most important thing he ever said to me. There was hundreds of things that I learned from him, but that's just one thing that springs to mind.
Yeah, Richard Mandela has saddled nearly 2,200 winners in his career. They've won more than $140 million in purses. Think about that. Those numbers are staggering.
Yeah,
and then you think about all the greatest stakes victories. What is it that sets a trainer like a Richard Mandela, like a Bob Baffert, you know, like a Todd Pletcher? What is it that sets these trainers apart from the rest of the field?
You just mentioned three guys who I am familiar with them, you know, and you mentioned three guys who personality-wise are all very, very different.
Yeah.
And I'd say their training styles are different too. They're all super successful at what they've, you know, and they've achieved a huge amount. I look up to all three of them as people, you know, in the industry. I aspire to maybe hopefully hold a candle for at some point in my life. You know, those guys, I think if you really wanted me to try and point out one thing that they all have in common, would be confidence. I mean, those guys, they're just confident in their own abilities, and they know that they can get a horse ready for a race better than anyone, you know. So I think that's probably, and then they all are very different. Other than that, I mean, I think that is one thing they all have in common.
How about for you, Dan, talking about a confidence level? You start your operation with just three horses in 2011. I'm sure there have been highs. I'm sure there have been lows. How does a trainer keep their confidence and stick to their guns, their program, during the low times?
That's a really good question. It's hard. And, when you worked for a lot of trainers as an assistant, you kind of mold your own system into the way you see to get the horses ready for the race as best you can, you know. And, you know, a lot of times you go through periods where, you know, you lose horses to other trainers or to retirement or such like. And, trying to stay level planed in terms of the way you go about your day-to-day routine, try and stay as emotionally level as you can. That's real key. And one thing that I always remember that John Sheriffs told me, I galloped for John Sheriffs for a little bit, and he told me when I started training, he said, like, one thing, you know, you got to remember as a trainer is dealing with loss. He said, the better you deal with loss, the better trainer you're going to be. And that really stuck with me. And he said, you're going to lose horses. You're going to lose owners. You're going to lose horses to retirement, to other trainers. You're going to lose owners. You're going to lose a lot. And you're going to lose, even if you're the best trainer in the country, you're still going to be losing 70% of the time. So you better just get used to losing, because it's a lot of it. And the better you can deal with that, suck it up and just keep moving forward and stay positive, that's what's going to make you a better trainer than your contemporaries.
Yeah, it's great advice. We hear that a lot in Major League Baseball too, where they say, okay, you can fail 2 out of every 3 times. You can get up there and strike out 2 out of every 3 times, and you're going to be in the Hall of Fame. And you have to learn how to deal with those times where you're not successful in order to not let them get to you and get under your skin. And it sounds like it's very similar with a horse trainer.
Yeah, it's so, as with all sports, it's so mental. Just staying focused, keeping to your plan, keeping to your routine, not changing if you're having a bad run. You know, every trainer has a bad run. And, as long as you just stay focused, keep on the track that you know, then everything will come back, fall back into place. And I think that's, it's important just to stay mentally focused. I have a hard time. There's no doubt about it. My wife will tell you. Like, there's some days I get real down, you know. It's like when you just on a bad run, and it's hard. It's really hard to keep staying positive. But that's something you just work on and stay focused and try and improve on.
Has there been a time when you said, you know what, maybe I made the wrong decision. Maybe I should have stuck with the geoscience stuff.
Yeah, like, it happens all the time. When I get a horse, when a horse doesn't run as well as you think, you're like, oh, well, I shouldn't go work to get a job at Starbucks or whatever. But, there's, as I said, there's always downtimes. It's just, when I come in the morning the next day, and then you just around the horses, you just try and start every day fresh. I get down after a horse doesn't run well that night, but I try and wake up the next day and start afresh, be positive. And when I get to the barn and go down and check all the legs and see the horses, that just like picks me back up, and it's like a new lease of life. So that's generally the way I try and keep going in a positive manner.
He's Dan Blacker. I'm Mike Penna. You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Dan, how were you able to build this operation, build your business from the 3 horses you started with in 2011 to where you are today and on the doorstep of starting a horse in a Breeders' Cup race?
It's the American dream. You know, like nowhere else in the world. I mean, none of the major racing jurisdictions around the world do you have the opportunities as a trainer as like you do in America. It's very unique here. Like back home in England, there's a lot of, typically you need a huge amount of financial backing to get going as a trainer. I mean, people say you need £1 million. That's like 1,200, $1.2 million just to start training. Like that's the craziness of it over there. And because you've got to rent a yard, you have to fill the boxes with as many horses as you can. And
wow,
it's just a lot of pressure, you need a huge amount of financial backing over there to get going. America, when you come here, you get two horses, you go see the racing secretary, you say, hey, can I get two stalls? And they'll say, yeah, barn 12, stalls 1 and 2. And away you go. There's your training career started. So it's like, it's so much easier to get going as a young trainer here. And if you're passionate and you show owners that you are willing to work really hard and win races, then people are going to give you a shot. And it's not like that back home. And it's not like that anywhere else, I don't think. And that's what's so unique about America. Is when I started training, I was very lucky. Jamie Lloyd, who was another trainer here, he quit training and went back to England to work on his bloodstock career and his family. He put in a good word with some owners and said, oh, I'm going to give you, hopefully get you 10 horses, get you started. I was like indebted to Jamie to get my foot in the door with the training. And 10 horses, actually, when push come to shove, ended up being 3 horses. So I got going. I went and saw the racing sector at Hollywood Park. He said, yeah, you got 3 stalls. And away we went. I borrowed a little money just to buy some webbing, some things like that, and some tack. And I bought some tack off Gary Stevens, who had just quit training, who's a good friend of mine that I met back in France when I was working there. It's another story. But he had just quit training, and he was like, oh, yeah, you can have all this. So I borrowed some stuff, bought some stuff here and there, and away we went. And, you know, like, that's why I love America. It's like people here are just so open to giving young people a chance. And if you're good, as I said, if you work hard, you're passionate, you show people that you're knowledgeable and you really want to win and be successful, then people are going to give you a chance. It's not about what your last name is or who your mother and father are or how much money you got behind you. So that's how I got going.
What's different about Dan Blacker now as a trainer than when you first started in 2011?
That's a good question. I think I obviously got my family. I'm a lot more, I was 100% focused on my, winning races, training, and on my barn then. And now I have, what's more important to me is my family, my children. And, I want to, if I'm successful in life, I determine that to be whether my children grow up to be, have a great childhood and go up and be successful in themselves. And then hopefully at the same time as that, I can also be a successful horse trainer as well. But that's probably the main difference. Just my focus is much more on my family nowadays. But at the same time, I'm very driven at what I'm doing as well, my professional life.
You know, I can remember asking, well, Richard Mandela being one, but I've asked several trainers this question on this program over the 8 years now that I've been doing it. And I always ask them, about other hobbies or interests that they have outside of horse racing. And some will have other interests. But for most, especially Richard Mandela, he said, this is it. This is all I know. This is all I care about. This is what I love. And he's so singularly focused. How about you? Are there other things? You mentioned your children. But are there other things that will take your attention away from horse racing a little bit at times?
Yeah, I do. I'm kind of slightly different in that respect. I do have a lot of – I love surfing. That's something that I picked up since I started living in California, and I take my oldest daughter surfing a bit, and that's probably my secret hobby. But ultimately, like, you don't – once you're doing this, you don't have much free time at all. And if I go and do something else that isn't spending time with my children, I feel really guilty. And I do love spending time with them as well. So it's not like I feel like it's a burden, But when I'm not at the barn, I'm mostly spending time with my children because that's, I don't have a lot of free time. So that's what I do when I'm not working at the barn.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful sentiment too, Dan. We spent some time, obviously, talking about Hit the Road, who will compete in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. But outside of Hit the Road, I'm sure there's other horses that you've worked with that you would say, yeah, this horse is really special. I'm never going to forget this horse. I'm never going to forget the training job I did with this one horse in particular. Talk about a couple of the other horses that stand out to you when you think back on your career so far.
Well, I will just say what you just mentioned. I mean, I would love to think that I've done some miraculous training job with this horse, but like, he is just a very talented horse. And, you know, I've been lucky to get some great owners that have given me good horses over the years, like Calumet and Harris Farms, Old English Rancho. And I've been lucky to get, they've been generous enough to give me a shot with some really good horses. But like this horse in particular, he's very talented and very precocious. And I'm just lucky to have him. I think of trainers as being like a college basketball coach, because, you know, the really great college basketball coaches, they are recruiting the whole time. They're going out looking for the next young kid that's going to come up. They recruit. And that's what we're like as trainers. Like, I'm just going out trying to recruit the best talent that I can possibly get and nurture that. And that's the deal. That's the job I've done with Hit the Road. You know, he's just an amazingly talented horse. And I just try and stay out of his way, keep him healthy, let him do his thing when he goes out there. And so, you know, I mean, the other horses that I've had, is, you know, that I stick in my mind, like Ritzy AP, he's been like a really hard-knocking horse for me for Calumet Farm. You know, Mr. Kelly was kind enough, and Eddie Kane had been kind enough to give me a shot with that horse. He was my first horse I had for them, and he's still with me now. So he means that he's really special place in my heart, that horse, and he always tries really hard. You know, he's graded stakes place now. He's knocking on the door of a graded stakes win. So he's probably like one of my most memorable horses, and he's still luckily in my barn right now. So he's going to run in the Lure Stakes next week on the Thursday before Breeders' Cup. So he's one that sticks in my mind. And then another cowbred filly called Wonderful Lie. She was the first ever filly I bought at public auction for $25,000, and she ended up winning like $200,000. And she was a really fun partnership I put together. So she was one that sticks in my mind as well.
Yeah, you talk about being a recruiter, like a college basketball coach. So when you go to the sales and you're looking for your next future star, what are some of the attributes that you want to see in those young horses, Dan?
That's a good question. It's something that, you know, Craig Rounsfell, and who's a bloodstock agent that I work with a lot, and Connor Foley of Oracle Bloodstock, all three of us went through the Dali program together. But those two guys are the guys that I work mostly with at the horse sales. And, you know, we look for a lot of things in terms of physical and on paper and the way the horse mentally and their presence and things like that. But like, you know, I think there's a lot of boxes we try and tick when we go into the sales. You can't always tick every box because those horses are bringing $1 million. But you just try and look for certain things that you really love. Like I like a powerful hind leg and a real presence and a good mind, you know, those sort of things. That's something I'd look for if you really wanted to narrow it down to something. But it's really tough to focus on one thing. And a lot of the things I rely on the agents like Connor and Craig to guide me and help me out there, because it's a real team effort and it requires a lot of work leading up to each sale.
You talk about horses that check all the boxes, bringing millions of dollars, and they do. What's the highest price that you've ever gone to for a young horse?
Craig and I bought a filly by Street Sense last year, the same sale as Hit the Road. And it's a filly, her name is Eyes Open. And she hasn't run yet, but she is looking really, really good. She's up to her second half mile. I'm hoping, fingers crossed, she might be ready for a race down at Del Mar next month, but you know, we won't know until she kind of gets a little closer to the races. But she's one that I have high hopes for. We paid $375,000 for her. So lot riding on that. But she was one of our favorite fillies in the sale, so we're really pumped to get her for that, even for that price. We thought she was going to bring a lot more.
Is that a little nerve-wracking when you're getting ready to write a check for $375,000?
Well, we don't really write a check.
Well, I know what you mean.
But to answer your question, when your hand goes up and the hammer comes down,
right,
and they point to you and it says 375 off of the screen, when that was my most expensive horse I ever bought, so your hand does get a little shaky when you're signing a name on the ticket and signing Radley Equine, that's my stable name. If you go back and look at that slip at the sale, it's pretty illegible, to be honest, because I'm shaking.
He's trainer Dan Blacker, and getting ready to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Just about 3 minutes left here, Dan. So I'll end by asking you, what's on the bucket list? What are some of the goals that you've set out to achieve? Obviously, the Breeders' Cup win is going to be first and foremost, because that's the next thing on the horizon. But what other goals have you set out to achieve?
Be a good father. That's the number one. I just want my children to go up and be good people and hopefully be as successful as my wife. On a horse racing side, my professional, obviously everyone wants to win the Derby. But what I love about this game, I love working with the horses, but I love winning with people that I enjoy spending time with. Like, I have some super owners in Hit the Road, like Rick Gold, who's always been a big supporter of mine, Dan Cutting, Dave Odemark, these guys, and the Taste of Victory guys. You know, these guys have been big supporters of mine, and I'm just so pumped to have such a fun group of people in a good, great horse. And that's what I really enjoy, is not only spending time with these horses and on a day-to-day basis, but when you get a good one, having such a fun group of people and seeing the excitement and the enjoyment on their faces is why I do this, you know. And it's just when you win, there's nothing like it. It's like being part of your own mini sports franchise, and being for these guys, being part of the process, and then getting to that end goal, and then having a great horse, and then getting to the Breeders' Cup. There's really nothing like it. And that's why I do it. My goal for the future is just to have more, get more horses, better horses. Keep pushing on trying to focus on quality over quantity, getting good stakes horses for good owners, and keep pushing, raising the bar. So hopefully we'll be back next year with another one.
Yeah, well said. And I'll echo your sentiments. If you could take and bottle that feeling that you get watching your horse cross the finish line first, Dan, this would be the easiest sport in the world to market.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of like it's really, winning is like a drug, you know, and it's when you have that feeling, and then after the win, you know, after the dust settles, and it's like, okay, when's the next race? You know, it's just you're always looking for the future. What's the next thing? I got a worker tomorrow. I got, you know, owners coming to the barn. There's always something that's happening that next minute, that next hour, that next day. It's something going on next week. We're always looking to the future.
Well, Dan, I'm pretty sure I know what the future holds for you, and that's a start in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile with Hit the Road. So Juvenile Turf, I should say, with Hit the Road. So good luck with that, Dan, and really appreciate you spending some time with me here tonight. I've enjoyed the visit. We could have spent two more hours talking about horse racing and about your life and your background. Keep it rolling. Say hi to Christina and the kids, and I'll see you out there in California.
Mike, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Dan Blacker here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Wow, what an hour that was. If you missed any of it, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Do yourself a favor. Go back and listen again. Really good guy, really sharp trainer, and wish him all the best with Hit the Road coming up on Friday afternoon. Head over to our website, too, to check out a full Breeders' Cup schedule. You can see it all right there, all the SiriusXM channel information, and you can listen worldwide at horseracingradio.net, and follow us on social media at HRN. On Twitter. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, for Dan Blacker, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.